Chapter 7. The Engineers. The 50-year-old Soviet biplane lurches, banks hard to the left, and nearly pitches me and the 9 hackers aboard into the port side windows. I resist the urge to vomit as my stomach floats into my chest. The fluffy-bearded young man sitting behind me doesn't, and pukes generously into a paper bag. A few thousand feet below the fuselage of steel in which we're riding is a German landscape covered with trees, rivers, windmills, and suddenly a field populated with a patchwork of multicolored tents and strips of pavement. Our pilot, a tall Berliner with a sadistic smile, pushes the Antonov AN-2 into an alarmingly steep descent, testing my nervous system's accelerometers again. And then, with unexpected grace, the landing wheels connect with a tarmac and we glide to a stop. As the plane's Shvetsov engine sputters to a halt and passengers tumble out dazedly, 2 men approach, one with long purple hair and the other with a brown military hat, a thick black beard, and a suit and tie. They welcome us to the Chaos Communication Camp. The CCC, or simply CAMP, as it's called by the transnational hackers who regularly attend, occurs every fourth summer at an airfield in Finnefurt, a tiny town in former East Germany, an hour outside of Berlin. For 5 days, a distinct hacker-hippie culture takes shape in a village of tents, veined with power cords and Ethernet, and permeated with Wi-Fi. The 3,000 or so hackers hold research presentations in underground hangars on code-breaking, government surveillance, and insanely ambitious DIY projects. One talk at the latest camp set a new goal for the CCC. Put a hacker on the moon by 2034. At night, they build elaborate light shows and sculptures around the remains of the Soviet aircraft and tanks that litter the terrain. The result is something like a colder, wetter Burning Man for the radical geek elite. I spend my first 2 hours at the Chaos Communication Camp wandering in the dusk around the surreal ruins, past a statue of Lenin with headphones and turntables added to convert him into a socialist DJ, a rusting fighter jet with elaborate rainbow-knitted caps for its pointed engines and nose. Hackers have bivouacked in the shelter of defunct missiles and helicopter engines, like survivors of the apocalypse who have rebuilt a simpler digital society amid the remains of the military-industrial complex. It's only after nightfall that I find Daniel Domscheit-Berg standing in the dark at the edge of the airfield, wearing a long, reflective yellow coat, his face looking rather forlorn as it's lit by another hacker's headlamp. I call out his name, and he turns and greets me with a wide-eyed smile and a handshake. The 33-year-old engineer is Assange's darkened doppelganger, nearly as tall and slim, but with dark, short hair, dark-rimmed glasses, dark beard. I ask him how it's going. "Everything's going wrong," he says, without dimming his innocent, slightly gap-toothed smile. "We're full 2 days behind." By we, Domscheit-Berg means OpenLeaks, his nascent spin-off from WikiLeaks. Birgitte Jonsdottir, who flew in to support the group, is sick in a hotel, he tells me. Her young son tripped on a tent stake, twisted his ankle, and is in the hospital. And 90-mile-per-hour winds have been pummeling the 2-room army tent OpenLeaks has set up as a headquarters, strong enough that the hackers have spent most of the last 48 hours trying to prevent it from collapsing. "This afternoon, we were helping to set up the marquee tent," he says in a plaintive German accent, pointing to a dome 50 yards away. "Then the storm hit, and 10 minutes later it ended up looking like some kind of modern art installation." Domscheit-Berg invites me into the tent, an orangish structure with what looks like a small Tibetan shrine in one corner, an anti-nuclear poster, couches, and cases piled on cases of Clubmate, the sugary, highly caffeinated tea favored by nocturnal German hackers. He hands me a bottle, sits down on the couch, picks up his laptop, and then, without apology, gets back to work. For Domscheit-Berg, after all, tomorrow is a big day. For the first time, he plans to open OpenLeaks' leak submission platform to the world. With this launch, Domscheit-Berg and the other young men milling around the OpenLeaks tent and buried in computer screens don't merely expect that their newly coded system will be attacked. They're asking for it. We will open the system for 96 hours to a penetration test, Domscheit Berg wrote to me by instant message a month before the camp. We want people to break it. OpenLeaks, in other words, aims to harden its code in the fire of 3,000 hackers simultaneously probing it for vulnerabilities and leaks. If it still works and is not compromised, I think we are in a good position to go live, he wrote. Going live has been a long time coming. Domscheit Berg left WikiLeaks in an epically messy divorce in September 2010. He announced OpenLeaks 3 months later. He planned to launch his first test with the site's media partners, four small European newspapers and the nonprofit Food Watch, in January 2011. Then April. Now it's August. And OpenLeaks has yet to even launch its submissions website, fueling the frustration of its supporters and the schadenfreude of Domscheit Berg's former colleagues at WikiLeaks. It's not just putting up a website, Domscheit Berg counters patiently when I interrupt his typing to ask about this long delay. We're working on an end-to-end environment that takes into regard the whole process. What kind of material you get, what the requirements are to access that material to make sure there's no security breach, how to allow lots of people to work on the material and redact it, how to encrypt it so that only the partners can decrypt it and we can't, adding checks in the system so that if there's a maintenance window, nothing is exposed. We're working on a seriously engineered solution. The long gestating system is designed to allow the same anonymous whistleblowing as WikiLeaks. But unlike the parent project, where Domscheit Berg spent 3 years of his life, OpenLeaks isn't designed to actually make anything public. Instead, it aims to securely pass on leaked content to partnered media organizations and nonprofits, avoiding the dicey role of publisher that got WikiLeaks into so much trouble. It will focus, Domscheit Berg says, on the most technically tricky and crucial link in the leaking chain: untraceable, anonymous uploads. Domscheit Berg believes he has all the ingredients to build a new WikiLeaks that's more efficient, more democratically organized, and perhaps, most important, more legal. He wants to incorporate as a nonprofit a steadfast, permanent institution that can strike blows for information freedom against the world's governments and corporations without needing to hide from anyone. But there's another difference from WikiLeaks. Domscheit Berg believes that merely replicating the previous project's security isn't good enough. Not only because, the former WikiLeaker says, Julian Assange's brainchild never quite reached his ideal standards for data protection, nor because, despite his denials, the German is still playing out a dark and bitter game of one-upsmanship with Assange himself, who once counted Domscheit Berg a close friend and now publicly casts him as one of the leaking movement's greatest villains. In a newspaper interview a few months earlier, Assange called Domscheit Berg a dangerous, malicious con man. But also because in the year since WikiLeaks began dropping nuclear data bombs on world superpowers, the stakes have risen considerably. WikiLeaks appeared out of nowhere, says Domscheit Berg. It caused a lot of new problems no one had thought about before. But now they've thought about this whole thing for a bit. The dust has settled, and it will never be as easy again. Hence, Domscheit Berg's plan for the entire Chaos Communication Camp to pile on OpenLeaks data conduit in a massive hackfest starting tomorrow. Better to be attacked by friends first than intelligence agency spooks and state-sponsored hackers later. There was a Swiss newspaper that wrote something like, "First there's a visionary, and then come the engineers," Domscheit Berg says. That's what's happening with us as well. Julian had the vision, paired with the spirit to kick this off. We are the engineers. In March 2011, while late to a meeting and running down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, I received a call on my BlackBerry from Sarah Harrison, Julian Assange's personal assistant. "Julian would like to speak with you," she tells me. "Great. When?" I ask cheerily, trying to restrain my out-of-shape panting. Suddenly, Sarah's voice has been replaced with Assange's, and he's launched into a critique of my latest blog post, a bit of news about WikiLeaks' reaction to plans for an upcoming film based on two books, one by two reporters at The Guardian and one by Domscheit Berg, neither of which portrays Assange in a flattering light. "This is how bullshit ends up being history," a WikiLeaks staffer had written on Twitter earlier in the day. On the other end of the phone, Assange is taking issue with how I described Domscheit Berg in my story as having left WikiLeaks in September 2010 and taking several staffers with him. "He did not leave. He was suspended," Assange says in a scolding tone. "And he did not take several staffers with him. He took one." I later spoke face-to-face with several staffers who had left WikiLeaks at the same time as Domscheit Berg, two of whom had gone on to work for OpenLeaks. "What this shows me, Andy," he continues slowly in the manner of a disappointed school headmaster, "is that you're not properly checking your facts." I can sense the subtext of this one-way conversation. I've quoted Domscheit Berg in recent stories, and Assange knows that I and every other journalist covering WikiLeaks have read Domscheit Berg's just-published memoir, which describes Assange as an arrogant tyrant and a selfish, petty nerd, complete with descriptions of him mistreating his German compatriot's cat, eating his Ovaltine straight from the package, and possessing the table manners of someone raised by wolves. I point out that checking facts with him is difficult when Domscheit Berg returns my phone calls and Assange doesn't. Then I try to explain that my primary interest in speaking with Domscheit Berg is not to insert myself into the feud between him and Assange, but rather to learn more about OpenLeaks and what it's doing to continue the work Assange began. "As far as I can tell, it's doing nothing," Assange says. "That's true, I suppose, but I'm interested in the ideas behind it and where they're going," I respond lamely. "Then you should know that every idea in OpenLeaks is my idea," Assange replies without hesitation. "So I'm glad you like my ideas." I'm not quite sure how to respond to this, and we sit on the phone in silence for a moment. "I have to go now, Andy," he says. Then he hangs up. If Assange had violated his house arrest in England, flown to Germany, made a surprise appearance at the Chaos Communication Camp, and personally pegged Daniel Domscheit Berg with a piece of rotten fruit during the announcement of OpenLeaks' test launch, perhaps the otherwise near-total failure of the day would have been complete. Domscheit Berg takes the stage inside one of the camp's hangars, and within a few minutes, he's delivering bad news, admitting to the packed room of hackers that after months of delay, the test site still isn't yet online. He complains in passive-aggressive terms that the camp staff hadn't properly set up their server co-location facility. He goes on to explain all the massive technical challenges OpenLeaks faces. How, for instance, to set up secure anonymous submission systems on the websites of media outlets that use widgets and tools that make online anonymity nearly impossible. Tracking tools included in newspapers' web advertisements collect data on users to better sell them cars and toothpaste. Anonymous leaking sites aren't meant to collect any data at all. Many of the scripts that run in visitors' web browsers when they visit media sites can even be rigged to gain control of the user's computer. And given that OpenLeaks doesn't plan to run its submissions system exclusively as a Tor hidden service, the group sees them as too complex for many users to access, Domscheit Berg explains that they need to come up with anonymity protections that don't rely solely on popular anonymity tools like Tor. After listing this litany of problems, Domscheit Berg neglects to explain how OpenLeaks will solve any of them. Instead, he jumps right into his call for the camp's hackers to pile on to the test site as soon as it comes online. He assures the crowd it will be up shortly, and examine it for security flaws. "All of you are so important in determining what the future looks like, the technical side of the future, and what the influence will be on the freedoms in society," he says in a short pep talk. "This goes to the heart of society. If we don't come up with solutions, who else will?" But when Domscheit Berg's idealistic speech ends and the floor opens for questions, the crowd's skepticism comes pouring out. The first darkly worded statement is made by a member of the audience that Domscheit Berg considers a longtime friend, Jacob Applebaum. "I think it would be really fantastic if everything you do is free software, and I want to advocate that you make sure everything you do is free software," Applebaum says. To the hackers present, the suggestion carries two shades of meaning. First, free software can be freely used by other organizations with similar aims. But free, as in open source, software, can also be thoroughly checked for security bugs, both ones included by mistake and others planted for covert spying. The young activist follows his comment with a question about OpenLeaks' purported association with the German Privacy Foundation. "I don't know if it's true, but I've heard those guys are just a front for the defense intelligence agencies of Germany," he says. "My question is, if you have a foundation, how do you avoid being infiltrated by all the bad motherfuckers that want to infiltrate your organization? And how would you take a rumor like that one that the Privacy Foundation are related to the spooks and vet it? If you found out they were spooks, would you stop working with them or not?" A round of tentative applause follows. "I'm a German. I know this problem," Domscheit Berg responds with a thin smile. "I know all these rumors. And the problem is that you don't know what to make of that. I've been reading about myself that I might be paid by the FBI, which is not the case." "It was you!" someone shouts from the back of the room to some sparse laughs. Domscheit Berg smiles and jokingly puts one finger over his lips. "We shouldn't be scared just by all these rumors," Domscheit Berg continues, unflustered, "because that won't enable us to do anything." Then Birgitta Jonsdottir, who has been sitting quietly near the front of the room, pipes up. "Paranoia will kill us," she says loudly and matter-of-factly. "Yes, I agree with Birgitta," echoes Domscheit Berg, sounding tired. "Paranoia will kill us." The jabs continue, many picking up on Applebaum's open-source critique. "What could possibly justify that every bit of software produced so far is not released as free speech software?" fumes one young hacker. "It is free software. It's just not open source right now," Domscheit Berg responds, arguing that making code open source requires constant time-consuming bug fixes that OpenLeaks can't yet afford to make. "This is due to the overhead." "Where's the code? Where's the code?" the critic interjects with controlled anger. Another member of the audience asks that OpenLeaks simply publish the SSH password to its servers so that anyone can get into the computers remotely and see exactly what they're doing. Domscheit Berg shakes his head. "You can't run this like a zoo where everyone can go and watch," he says. Near the end of the line of questioners stands CCC board member Andy Müller-Magun, a pale and wide-bodied German with compact facial features, a tuft of thin hair on his forehead, and clear blue eyes. "I'm trying to find out what's open about OpenLeaks," he says evenly. "I had hoped you would use the principle of openness to ensure the integrity and trustworthiness of the project. For now, you haven't convinced me you're doing that." Domscheit Berg can only respond by begging for time again, saying that the group will probably open parts of the site's code to the public. "You'll have to take my word as much as that's not optimal," he says weakly. "That's all I can give." And then comes the final person in the line of interrogators, John Gilmore, the venerable bearded and ponytailed co-founder of the Cypherpunks and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. His mere appearance at a conference east of the Mississippi River is a meaningful event. In 2002, Gilmore filed and lost a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security that contested the constitutionality of its practice of asking for his identification before boarding an airplane. Since then, he's vowed never to board a domestic U.S. flight again, and so has had to fly directly from San Francisco to Europe. "I just want to thank you for trying to do this work," Gilmore begins with the calm of an elder statesman. "Because if you succeed at it, We get transparency in other parts of the world that have not had it. And if you fail at it, or if people think that you're lame or whatever, maybe you inspire them to do it better. It's hardly a glowing endorsement, but the crowd applauds more than it has for any other comment. Over the next hours, it becomes clear that OpenLeaks' immediate problem isn't a debate over open or closed-source software, or even a whisper campaign about its supposed cooperation with intelligence agencies. It simply can't get online. The test platform for OpenLeaks is meant to be a submission system for the left-leaning newspaper Die Tageszeitung, TAS for short. But an hour after Domscheit Berg's talk, leaks.taz.de still returns a page-not-found message. Moving from the camp's facilities to an outside data center is taking OpenLeaks' crew longer than they expected. 2 hours pass with no leak site online, then 3, then 24. On the second day of camp, I meet with Rainer Metzke, the editor-in-chief of Die Tageszeitung, who has been camping for the first days of the conference in a small tent next to OpenLeaks' temporary headquarters to oversee the launch of leaks.taz.de. But now he's packing up his things to head back to Berlin, with little to celebrate about his paper's bold step into the future of leaking. In a very restrained German way, Metzke is extremely pissed off. He opens his laptop to show me a headline on the website of the competing German newspaper Die Zeit. Leaking sky prevents OpenLeaks launch, mocking Domscheit Berg's excuse that the storm hindered their preparations. Here's why this is a PR disaster, he explains as he stuffs his belongings into a bag and rolls up his tent. We made a big splash. The hackers who come here are still mythical for media people. They're coming here, throwing it into the ring to fight with this server. It's a story that every news shift staffer can get immediately. It was a story that was running in every meaningful German newspaper. Millions of people saw it. And now a high percentage tried to get to the website. And then again. And again. Nothing happened. Tomorrow the whole thing goes poof and vanishes from the media. Metzke had hoped to tout that Die Tageszeitung's OpenLeaks submissions platform had passed the test of 3,000 hackers attacking it. He isn't looking forward to explaining to his staff that a launch in which his paper had invested a significant chunk of reputation and a front-page story simply didn't happen. And he worries the damage may be worse than embarrassment. Leak sites have to first have a leak, he says. But how do you get this leak? For that, you need publicity. Now the publicity is there, and the website is not. And maybe some of the leakers are turned off. In the short run, it's a disappointment. But in the long run, the issue is the leaks. To leak or not to leak, he adds with a grim laugh as he packs up his things and prepares to head into the OpenLeaks tent to meet with Domscheit Berg. That is the question. Birgitte Jonsdottir's warning about the destructive power of paranoia must have rung a special bell for Domscheit Berg. It was paranoia that introduced the man known then as Daniel Berg to Julian Assange, and it was paranoia that pushed the two into acts of mutual sabotage that would cause each of them more harm than any state intelligence adversary has yet been able to inflict. Daniel Berg was born in the West German town of Wiesbaden, the son of an engineer who was the son of an engineer. He grew up playing with Fischer Technic mechanical toys. As a small child, he used the plastic motors and gears to build a functional refrigerator and a light sensor on the stairs up to his bedroom. The latter gadget was intended to alert him to his mother's approach so he could pretend to be sleeping and continue reading late into the night. Berg's family bought a Commodore 64 in 1986, when he was 8 years old. It had an interface that allowed him to connect the computer to his Fisher components, and he was amazed to see how the unassuming box of silicon let him program creations like a robotic hand and bring the inanimate plastic to life. When Berg was 13, he bought a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf from a man selling illegal Nazi paraphernalia at a flea market. The book was then banned in Germany, and it fascinated and terrified the teenager. He had heard his grandfather's World War II stories. One had been stationed on a minesweeping boat in the North Sea, the other in Poland. Both had deserted near the end of the war. One was shot in the leg during his escape and arrived home in Wiesbaden in such a terrible state that his own mother and brother didn't recognize him. But Hitler's sinister vision pushed Berg to read on about the war and its atrocities. Books like The Diary of Anne Frank, The Order of the Death's Head, and about the dreaded Schutzstaffel and Hell's Gate, about the concentration camp in Ravensbrück on the outskirts of Berlin. And he was struck by the foolishness of hiding such a dark piece of the country's history as the memoir of its former Führer. Soon his interest in banned words and computers began to mesh. His only friend, who owned his own PC, set up a bulletin board that allowed them to share files across phone lines. It had a total of about 6 regular users. But at one point, one of them posted a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook, about as exciting a piece of digital contraband as any bored teenager could hope to discover. Berg and his friends used the virtual tome's recipes to mix their own gunpowder and create homemade firecrackers from common chemicals. For a few months, we were completely crazy about explosives, Domscheit Berg says. They experimented with melting through various materials and even obtained a few of the ingredients for plastic explosives. One night, they borrowed an antique cannon on wheels from one of the friend's parents who were away on vacation, filled it with homemade gunpowder, and at 3 a.m. fired it at a neighbor's garage before running gleefully into the dark. The teenagers hadn't actually inserted a cannonball, so their stunt resulted only in a thrilling bang and a garage door completely blackened by soot. Berg was an extremely average, entirely unmotivated student. But he read the books his father, a data center engineer for a German insurance company, left lying around the house. And during his high school summers, he worked for a cabling company, laying 4-inch-thick electrical and networking copper lines and connecting them into data centers to keep up with the mid-1990s nearly infinite optimism about the coming deluge of data. With that tech boom underway, Berg sought little reason to go to a university. He got a job at a consulting company, building and tweaking networks for corporate customers. In his spare hours, he and his friends took an abandoned house, owned by one of their parents, and turned it into a kind of proto-hackerspace, filling its empty rooms with their computers, networking equipment, and records, and hauling couches up to its flat roof. It was surrounded by trees so that no one could see what we were doing, he says. For one summer, we were totally free. In the earliest days of wireless internet, Berg's crew would pile into his tiny Renault 5, packing it with 5 bodies and as many antennas as they could buy or scavenge, and go war driving. Wi-Fi encryption was still rare, so most networks were wide open. At one point, they climbed to the highest local point, Mount Neroberg, and used a 5-foot antenna to access the Wi-Fi of a university 10 miles away. On another war drive, they discovered an office management company's open network and mapped out its architecture with its connections to satellite offices in Dresden, Munich, Hamburg. At the time, it was the most complex network I had ever seen, says Berg. They watched its traffic and studied it for 2 months, until one of Berg's more reckless friends decided to send a note to every printer in the building that the staff should turn off a light they had left on overnight in an upstairs office. It printed on every printer in the office, again and again, until the machines ran out of paper. 2 days later, the wireless network wasn't there anymore, says Berg. I think we had freaked them out. In 2001, a friend told Berg about the Chaos Computer Club, and he attended a local meeting and then later the Chaos Communication Congress in Berlin. The 23-year-old Berg had not only never met so many politically savvy hackers, he had never even been to the capital city. It was a life-altering experience. The first conference blew me away, he says. It really got me out of my provincial thinking. Despite his budding hacktivist tendencies, Berg kept to the trajectory of technically skilled young men. When the heady days of the dot-com boom ended, he went to a technical university in Mannheim to study computer science and upon graduation got a job with the giant IT consultant EDS. Barrick made a deal with his manager that he wouldn't work for defense contractors or intelligence agencies, so instead spent his days setting up networks for car manufacturers and airlines. It was uninspiring work that left Barrick with plenty of extra brain matter for CCC-inspired daydreaming. He read and donated to Cryptome regularly and had been intrigued by its mega-leaks of intelligence officers' names over the previous decade. So when John Young posted his leak of WikiLeaks' early mail list discussions, including Young's paranoid implication that the site was a CIA front, it caught the German engineer's attention. Barrick, who had read Assange's autobiographical Underground, was captivated by the twisted notion of a legendary hacker turned government informant creating an elaborate cryptographic honeypot. Then, in November 2007, WikiLeaks leaked the official handbook of the Pentagon's Guantanamo prison, and it became clear that the site was no honeypot. Something about WikiLeaks pushed a button in Barrick that made him yearn for a mission beyond his daily network admin's grind. He wanted in. "I just didn't want to waste my life helping GM produce more cars anymore," he says. He posted a message on WikiLeaks' IRC chat room offering to help. 2 days later, he got a response from Julian Assange himself. "Still interested in a job?" For much of his first year with WikiLeaks, as Daniel Domscheit Barrick tells it, the group functioned as a blowfish, a small piece of sushi puffed up to look as large and dangerous as possible. It claimed to have thousands of active volunteers around the globe, a team of Chinese dissidents among its founders, a legal representative named Jay Lim on retainer, and servers spread across Europe. In fact, it had one server, a fictitious lawyer, and two members responsible for most all of its activities, Julian Assange and Daniel Barrick. They made an odd couple. Assange, the radical, homeless guerrilla hacker, and Barrick, the quietly subversive engineer with a corporate job, a carefully arranged apartment, and a favorite local organic foods grocery shop. Much of their interaction took place over instant messages, including the coordination of early bombshells like a collection of offshore account information from the Swiss bank Julius Baer and the secret documents of the Church of Scientology. But they would also attend three Chaos Communication Congresses together, each time with a higher-profile talk as WikiLeaks representatives, embark on a 1,500-mile road trip across Europe to find safe data centers to house their collection of servers, and even spend 2 months living together in Barrick's Wiesbaden home. Their personality contrasts occasionally flared into deeper conflicts over their idea of activism. One of the most representative, perhaps, was the issue of suits. Like Philip Zimmerman, Barrick subscribed to the Ellsberg strategy of protest. "We had some public appointments where I was convinced we could achieve more in conservative attire than in the normal slacker stuff we wore," he would write later. "Solid in appearance, subversive in performance. That was my motto." Assange agreed in theory, but in practice, his wayward lifestyle as an international subversive meant he dressed in shabby, wrinkled clothes and dirty sneakers. The Australian was deeply annoyed by Barrick's occasional suggestions that he wear cleaner clothes or business attire, even when meeting with government officials. The suit issue represented a fundamental disconnect between Barrick's and Assange's vision for WikiLeaks. When donations to the nonprofit group started to trickle in, Barrick dreamed of using the money to transform the group into a legitimate nonprofit with permanent infrastructure, state-of-the-art servers, a headquarters in a former military air raid shelter with a WikiLeaks flag flying above it, a computer center with space for partners to host their own projects. But Assange said he wanted to remain an insurgent operation. Even in late 2010, he would describe WikiLeaks to me in the same terms as his wandering youth. "We're like a traveling production company. Everyone moves somewhere, and we put on a production." That nomadism, Assange believed, helped WikiLeaks to stay a step ahead of legal and political threats. And Assange saw those threats everywhere. He believed he was constantly being tailed by intelligence services or having his travel plans sabotaged by state agents. When he stayed at Berk's apartment, he insisted they never enter or leave at the same time. He used a multitude of temporary SIM cards and avoided all payment forms other than cash. Berk believed that Assange simply had a flair for spy novel sensationalism that served as marketing for WikiLeaks. His greatest mistake, in retrospect, may have been underestimating Assange's capacity for true paranoia, both justified and not. Personal differences aside, they worked well as a team. They also became close friends, or so Berk believed. In 2009, he quit his job with EDS and went to work with WikiLeaks full-time. Around the same period, a third central figure appeared within the group. He was an old acquaintance of Berk's and a highly skilled network engineer, one whose caution regarding privacy dwarfed that of even Assange or Jacob Applebaum. His name has never been publicly linked with WikiLeaks, and many within the group don't know it either. To most, he is simply known as the Architect. Berk asked the Architect to help with a specific technical problem, one that Domscheit Berk wouldn't even describe to me for fear of providing more information on the man's specific abilities. The Architect handled the task with a degree of efficiency that deeply impressed the German WikiLeaker, who praises his skills as superior to any he had ever seen, including Assange's. Birgitta Jonsdottir calls the Architect a genius. Smára McCarthy, the Icelandic WikiLeaker who later helped draft the IMI legislation, described him to me as frighteningly skilled. When the newly recruited engineer took a look at WikiLeaks' infrastructure, however, he was horrified. He saw it as a patchwork of hacked-together components with no thought put into its overarching structure. He soon demanded that the site be taken down and completely rebuilt, its tangled code and creaking servers replaced with a network of load-balanced hardware and efficient software with no loose ends that might offer security vulnerabilities. In a sign of both Assange's and Berk's respect for the Architect's judgment, no one argued. The site would be offline for the next 6 months. Pinpointing the moment when Berk and Assange's philosophical differences blossomed into full-out contempt and animosity isn't easy. Perhaps it was after Berk exploded at Assange in a cramped, dark, and stuffy hotel room in Reykjavik. Or maybe it was when Berk began to use the group's funds to pay for systems upgrades without asking Assange for his consent. But only one event has been publicly cited by both men as a clear spark for their conflict. When I asked Jacob Applebaum, he summarized it. Basically, Daniel should never have gotten married. Berk met Anke Domscheit at a falafel joint in Berlin in February 2010. She was 10 years his senior and had a young son, but they connected immediately. Domscheit was a consultant with Microsoft focused on open government, working on the same issues of transparency as Berk, and he was attracted to her unique style and idealism. Just 9 days later, they decided to wed. They planned to change both of their names to Domscheit Berk. Assange's first reaction when Berk told him about meeting Domscheit was to suggest that Berk dig up dirt on her that would be useful when they separated, a piece of advice that deeply wounded Berk. When Berk moved into Domscheit's apartment shortly after their relationship began, Assange chastised him for putting his full name on the door, a gross display of negligence in Assange's unspoken rules of operational security. In a written statement Assange would release 18 months later explaining Domscheit Berk's expulsion from WikiLeaks, he would mark that violation as the first sign that Berk couldn't be trusted with WikiLeaks' resources and materials. In the same statement, he went on to write that the girlfriend of a Mossad agent attended the Domscheit Berk's wedding, and to accuse Daniel Domscheit Berk of having given helpful information to U.S. intelligence agencies. He added that Anke Domscheit Berk worked with CIA agents during her time at the consulting firm McKinsey. Daniel Domscheit Berk flatly denies ever sharing any information with law enforcement or intelligence agents of any nation or hosting any at his wedding. He says he hasn't even dared travel to the United States since his time with WikiLeaks to avoid the possibility of having to answer questions about the group. For Anka Domscheitberg, Assange's charges struck her as absurd and maddening on another level altogether. In a long phone conversation just a few weeks after the Chaos Communication Camp, she explained to me, slowly with a certain amount of emotional reluctance, just why Assange's words had irked her so deeply. The older of the two Domscheitbergs spent the first 21 years of her life in East Germany before the fall of the Iron Curtain. One of her closest friends was a political dissident. In the year before the fall of communism, he was imprisoned on charges of drinking while driving a motorcycle, but treated as a political prisoner, placed in solitary confinement and often shackled to a radiator. She posed as his fiancée in order to visit him in prison, but all but one of her visitation appointments were cancelled by the warden. Domscheit sent letters to him, numbering them so that he could better track which ones were blocked. Eventually, she received an anonymous letter saying that a letter smuggling system her friend had set up had been discovered, and now none of her notes were reaching him. So instead, she began writing to the warden and to editors of local newspapers demanding his release. Domscheit was a student of textile art at a technical school in southeastern Germany, and later the same year she won a French language competition for art students with the prize of a 3-month fellowship at a studio in Paris. At the time, stuck behind the wall, "It's hard to describe just what a paradise that sounded like," she says. Before she could go, however, Domscheit was called to a nearby town's tourist office. Waiting for her was an officer in the East German secret police known as the Stasi. "Were you really so naive as to think you could take the scholarship without our permission?" she remembers him asking. "I tried to tell myself, so what, as my big dream disappeared," she says, her voice shaking with anger as she recounts the conversation. The agent explained that if she wanted to go to Paris, she would need to volunteer as a Stasi informant. She refused. He told her that it might cause problems for her father's livelihood as a doctor if she didn't cooperate. But Domscheit wouldn't budge. She was let go, but told to meet the same agent the next day in a parking lot. Early the next morning, he put her in a car and drove to a forest near the Czech border, still hung with fog in the early dawn daylight. Domscheit thought perhaps they were going to kill her and dump her body among the trees, as the Nazis had done with communists in the previous regime. But still, she refused to offer to work as an informant. The agent drove her back to town. The secret police's intimidation tactics had failed, and the hated wall fell just months later. Her friend was released from prison under an amnesty program, but Domscheit wouldn't make it to Paris until years later. In the end, no one got the scholarship. "It was too late to give it to someone else," she says bitterly. What a waste. Her experiences in that dark last chapter of the Soviet Union, she says, left her with a deep hatred for intelligence agencies and the closed, secretive surveillance society they represented. "I had to deal with the secret police in East Germany, and I'm happy to have survived that," she says, her voice still trembling slightly. "So when Julian Assange tells me that I worked with the secret services, it's like a punch in the face."